This is an ABC podcast.
I love talking to brain experts on this program. The lump of grey matter in your head is so complex and mysterious and so critically important. So when something goes wrong, there's a world of knowledge that needs to be discovered. Dominic Rowe is Professor of Neurology at Macquarie University in Sydney, and he's a leading researcher into neurodegenerative diseases like Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, and motor neurone disease. And it's the last of these that's the most troubling. There's so much about MND, which is the disease that Stephen Hawking suffered from, that remains unknown to us. In some cases, it seems to be caused genetically, but in most cases, it appears to be triggered by something in the environment, or maybe it's a complex mix of things in the environment. We just don't know. But Dominic Rowe and other researchers are chasing down some promising leads in the case of MND versus the human race. Hello, Dominic. Welcome.
Thank you.
Most people see the brain as the place where the self is located. How does a neurologist see the brain?
As the most remarkable thing known to humankind. So when you look up in the sky with our red moon the other night, our lunar eclipse, and you see the Milky Way, there are 10 to the 15 odd stars in the Milky Way. Well, we have more connections in our brain than there are in the Milky Way.
Hey, what? Really?
Yeah.
Wow. More brain connections than there are stars in the Milky Way.
Yeah.
In everyone's brain.
Yeah.
Wow.
And how that all plugs together and how it works is the most extraordinary structure and the most amazing mystery that ends up leaving you breathless.
So for you then, as neurology, kind of like it has all that, the kind of universe in the brain case, I suppose, mixed with human behavior, character, emotion, logic, and all those things.
And history, to how it interplays with history. So the giants of neuroscience over the last 300 years, you know, to read their interpretation of the brain and how that feeds forward into what we understand in the brain now is really quite amazing. You know, we stand with a lot of knowledge that comes to us, you know, relatively painlessly when you're growing up and going through university and studying neurology and medicine. But those quanta of knowledge were not acquired easily. And, you know, as someone who still tries to do research in neuroscience, you know, what we know about neuroscience and how these diseases are placed within knowledge of human disease, each little bit of information is painstakingly acquired.
I was joking with a colleague earlier saying that when we're thinking about the brain, of course, it's the brain thinking about itself. And, of course, you worry you're going to get into one of those kind of feedback loops.
A wormhole.
Yeah, wormhole. Like, we're looking down a hall of mirrors, essentially, which will make my computer crash and I'll need rebooting in this. Does it ever strike you as odd that the brain is thinking about itself, trying to understand itself?
Look, okay. I've always been a very concrete thinker. I think at high school I used to drive my English teacher nuts because I could not extrapolate or recapitulate. It was, you know, he would say to me as his criticism, your sentence should be a paragraph, you know, expound, develop it. But I, you know, I'm much better at developing ideas now in language than I was at 15, 16, 17.
Given that you're a researcher into neurodegenerative diseases, when we talk about neurodegenerative diseases, what exactly is it that is degenerating?
Well, neurons are the cells that in our brain that have multiple different purposes, and they're post-mitotic. So the cells that we have in our brain are the cells that were formed when we were embryos, and people talk about neurogenesis and stem cells within the adult human primate brain, but that's not a proven thing. So these cells that we have ability to remember, abstract thought, memory, movement, conscious and unconscious reactions to environments.
But not each one on its own. It's got it's got to do that as a network, doesn't
it? Yes. Yeah. And yeah. And it comes. And people hand wave about how this actually works, and still do. So there are many different theories of how these cells work in a network, in neuronal grouping, and it's the interaction that really is the how everything plugs and plays.
So what is actually the degenerating then when you are studying these diseases?
Well, there are, depending on the disease. So in for example, Alzheimer's disease, it's principally the cholinergic neurons.
That what is that?
So there are different transmitters in our brains, and how these cells talk to each other is through little chemical packets. And there are various different transmitters. So, for example, acetylcholine is a transmitter that enables cells to talk to each other, to activate and to lay down new memory. So if you use anticholinergics, you can impair people's memory.
So that's Alzheimer's, did you say, or Parkinson's?
Yeah, right, Alzheimer's disease. Right. But, you know, the brain is very frugal too, the human. So acetylcholine, the same transmitter that's responsible for memory, is also involved in the motor system. So it determines how your cells, your motor neurons, so you have two broad groups of motor neurons, one up in your motor cortex called upper motor neurons or BET cells. And they send messages down to your brainstem and spinal cord, and they're anterior horn cells or lower motor neurons. And those cells send long processes out to talk to your muscles. And they release these packets of acetylcholine that talks to the receptor that enables calcium to be mobilized within the cell. And then the special proteins in your myocytes then ratchet up and activate, and you contract one muscle and relax the other at the same time.
This is going, when I lift my arm like I'm doing now, up and down, that's what's going on, is it?
Absolutely. Right. And you do it completely transparently thousands of times a day, and you don't even have to think about it.
Are you saying like little chemical packets of chemical messages are going back and forward between my motor neurons in my head and my
spinal
muscles?
Spinal cord and your muscles.
Right. That's going back and forward.
Yeah, within fractions of a second.
I don't know, is that difficult? I might. It sounds very difficult, but this all happens with infinitesimal speed.
The messages from your spinal cord down to your muscle are traveling at about 50 meters a second, and similarly the messages inside your brain are traveling at about the same speed. So that's like.
So when you have something like motor neuron disease and neurons are being attacked, what is it that's doing the attacking?
Well, the motor neurons. So the broad term for motor neuron disease that's used around the world is amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. So the umbrella term is motor neuron disease, and there are 30, 40, 50 different forms of motor neuron disease.
And ALS is the most well-known
ALS,
of those.
Otherwise called Lou Gehrig's disease in the US. So ALS is one of the few diseases that attacks both upper and lower motor neurons. Now, why those cells get sick is what we're trying to work out. So 10% of people with motor neuron disease have a faulty gene. So they're part of families that have a faulty gene that, if you inherit this faulty gene, it ends up causing problems for your motor neurons. The first gene was identified in 1994, was a gene termed SOD1 or superoxide dismutase type 1. And this SOD1 is an enzyme that's present in every cell in your body. But a mutation in this gene, and there are several hundred mutations now identified in SOD1, ends up preferentially damaging motor neurons. And we don't know why. There's still, 24 years after the discovery, there's still debate as to how this gene abnormality translates into the biology that ends up in killing motor neurons. There are more than 30 genes that cause motor neuron disease. And we look after 50 families who have one of these faulty genes, and 50% of the people in these families will have motor neuron disease.
When you're explaining this in layman's terms, you like to use an analogy of knights and valets. Can you explain how that works?
Sure. So if we think of a motor neuron as a knight in shining armor, so inside the brain, we don't just have neurons. We have supporting cells, astrocytes, oligodendrocytes, and microglia. And these special cells, these microglia, they are akin to a valet to a knight. So we do know in motor neuron disease, similar to Parkinson's disease and Alzheimer's disease, that one of the first things that you see is that these microglia, these supporting cells, become unhappy. they change their what's called phenotype from a resting, supportive, nurturing type to a more aggressive, destructive type. And we don't know what determines that switch yet.
So the valet attacks the knight.
The valet attacks the knight. So the valet's job is to polish the knight's armour and make sure the fire's lit and to bring him his food and look after the horse. When the knight gets injured after battle, the valet's job is to tend his wounds. But if the knight gets injured too much in battle, the valet's job is actually to turn assassin and kill the knight.
Right, dispatch the knight.
Dispatch the knight.
Right, and so what you're saying then is when in people with motor neurone disease, the valet is just killing the knight. It's gone rogue, essentially.
And we don't know necessarily what those triggers are. We think that there are genetic triggers, as we know in monogenic disease, whether that's what's called an abnormal protein response.
So when you get, so it could be genetic or it could be environment. I'm just trying to not get stuck too much in the jargon here, because that sort of leaves me a bit way out there.
But it could be environmental, and the environmental triggers are probably multi-step.
So when a new patient comes to see you and suspects that there's something wrong, how quickly are you able to form an opinion about what might be wrong with that patient, Dominic?
Well, I see 2 to 3 new people a week with motor neurone disease. So motor neurone disease is classified as a rare disease. It's not rare where I sit. The arbitrary classification of a rare disease is 1 in 10,000. According to statisticians. And so the incidence of motor neurone disease in Australia is about 1 in 42,000. So that's the number of new people this year who will be diagnosed with motor neurone disease. It's about 800 new people. The prevalence is how many people in society have the disease, and that's about 1 in 14,000. So arbitrarily, it's classified as a rare disease. It kills 800 Australians a year. 2 Australians today will die from motor neurone disease. So it's classified as a rare disease principally because it kills you so quickly.
Oh, dear.
The average survival is just on 3 years. And so from diagnosis to death, the average survival is just on 3 years. There's a big range in that survival. So the quickest I've seen is 8 weeks from first symptom to death. My longest surviving patient at the moment is 34 years.
Oh, my God. That's a huge diversity in length of time there.
Well, the things that determine survival are whether you breathe or whether you maintain nutrition and hydration. So if those factors don't come into play, then your survival is going to be long. So, but if motor neurone disease starts affecting your swallowing and breathing straight up, then your survival factors are straight into play. And if you don't move quickly, then people's survival is limited.
So when people come to see you and it turns out they have motor neurone disease, what typically are the initial symptoms of something like that?
Yeah. Well, it depends. Motor neurone disease starts focally and spreads regionally. So it depends on where in the nervous system that it begins. So if it's affecting the nerve cells that supply your speech and swallowing, then you might have a little bit of slurring in your speech, and often that's misinterpreted as a mini stroke by the GP, or patients get sent to ENT surgeons. So this slurred speech sounds like you're a little bit pissed. Mm. Or you even might become a bit more dysarthric or have more slurred speech even with one glass of alcohol. So something that stresses your nervous system or inhibits your nervous system, the symptoms may become more apparent. If it's affecting your cervical spinal cord, you may have troubles with your fingers, so you could have difficulty putting on a cufflink or doing up a bow tie or pegging out the clothes on the clothesline, doing up a bra. And so there'll be a problem with dexterity that people will know or recognise. If it's affecting your lumbar spinal cord, then it could be, you know, one of my patients many years ago, his first symptom was he found that he couldn't kick a footy. So he's a rugby league player of very high level, and his first symptom was he went to kick a footy and he just couldn't kick it. He couldn't coordinate. He could usually punt the ball 50 metres and he couldn't do it. So, and as the story unfolded, it ended up that he had motor neurone disease.
So when someone comes in to see you, are you watching the way they walk before they even talk to you?
Yeah, and talk. So I'll go and greet people and shake their hand and talk to them. And often patients come to me, they've already been seen by other neurologists. So, you know, most GPs will not see a person with motor neurone disease in their whole career. Most neurologists see motor neurone disease two, three, four, five, maybe six times a year, they'll see a new patient. So and often those patients get sent on to us at Macquarie to look after with our clinic and research centre.
I'm with Dominic Rowe, who's a neurologist, trying to unlock the puzzle of motor neuron disease. He also works on Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease as well, the diseases that are called neurodegenerative. So I suppose a big part of your week then is giving terrible news to someone then and say you have motor neuron disease. Do you have a kind of way of approaching that, Dominic?
Yes. I talk to people how I would like to be talked to if the roles were reversed. I have a lot of time. I take a lot of time. I almost never talk to people when they're with me by themselves. So they have to be with their partner, carer, mother, father, son, daughter. You can imagine that people are sent to me for a further opinion with the possible diagnosis of motor neuron disease. It's a fairly charged atmosphere. I try to use humour, which sounds callous in the setting, but fortunately, I think I'm pretty good at establishing rapport. I use first names. There's no barrier between myself and the person that I'm talking to. So we sit sort of adjacent in my clinic room. My chair...
You sit side by side, do you?
Sort of in front of each other with a little desk in front. So it's not across a desk. My seat, I'm telling you all my trade secrets, is actually positioned so that my head is a little bit lower than the person who I'm talking to. So it's trying to make it, it's a corner room with lots of light. There's, you know, lots of rubbish and junk on the windowsills, you know, teddy bears and bits and bobs. So it's, I try to make it as non-threatening as possible, but having said that, it's still an awful situation for someone coming to see me with a possible diagnosis of motor neuron disease. So what I do is that I get given a whole heap of information and I don't actually give that too much weight. I just sit there and talk to the person and go through their history slowly, carefully, and we talk one-to-one, much like we're doing now. You know, what was your first symptom? When did it start? And so it's what investigations were done. So I'm have to rake over all of those coals because one in 20 people who get sent to see me with a diagnosis of motor neuron disease, they don't have it. So they actually have an alternative diagnosis. So, you know, when there's an old saying in medicine, when you hear the sound of hoofbeats, think of horses and not zebras. Well, my job is to think of zebras as well as kudu and wildebeest and whatever.
The thing about motor neuron disease, and correct me if I'm wrong, is it seems that unlike Alzheimer's, for example, it doesn't seem to affect your cognitive abilities as you decline. Like you're still thinking and your sensory powers and your thinking powers are all still working just fine. I don't know, how do you see that? Is that a cruel aspect of the condition?
Yeah, and by and large that is the case. So there are some people with motor neuron disease that can have some problems with what's termed executive function. So understanding, insight, complex tasks, sequencing, but mostly people's autobiographic and semantic memory. So the memory that makes them them and puts them in the context of their family is left untouched. And so I have many times said that I think that motor neuron disease is probably the cruelest disease. If you were going to design the cruelest disease from the get-go, you know, if you really were had a silence of the lambs type mentality, then you would design this disease as a torture because it leaves your vision, your hearing, your sense of smell, taste, touch.
And still, though, I suppose, though, the fact that it doesn't affect the sufferer that way is the reason why we were able to have Stephen Hawking's extraordinary mind available to us for so long, for all those years.
Yeah, and also, you know, very much the essence of how we look after people is how do you live with this disease? So it gives you the ability to have assistive and adaptive devices to enable people to communicate. So we do a lot of work with advanced technology that enables people to use, say, their muscle as a mouse, you know, that will talk Bluetooth to their iPad so that they can communicate and send texts and email if they can no longer talk, or even doing something simple as turning on the light or, you know, activating an alarm switch to get someone to help them.
When people show up to see you, do you get a fairly broad representation of the community? Is there any kind of, do you see a range of ages, gender, professions, that kind of thing? Or is it more one than another?
In motor neurone disease, it's a little bit more common in men than women. So it's about 1.4 to 1. My youngest patient in the last 20 years has been 19. My oldest patient was 96. So, and again, what happens in the very elderly is that often it's their symptoms are just ascribed to old age, whereas in fact they have a unique condition that needs to be put in the context of that person, not just because they're 96.
Have people always been getting MND? Can you look at cases from someone, I don't know, it's a description of someone from, I don't know, the 7th century or something, and go, oh, very likely that person had MND? Or is this a fairly new phenomenon?
No, well, it was first described in the 1850s by Jean Charcot, the father of modern neurology, who worked at Salpetriere, the old gunpowder factory in Paris, in the 14th arrondissement. So he called it amyotrophic lateral sclerosis from the post-mortem changes that occur in the spinal cord. So people amyotrophic, so loss of muscle, lateral, so it's the corticospinal tract in the lateral cord, becomes hard, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. But in fact, there are descriptions in monographs that go back, you know, 10, 20, 100, 200 years prior to that.
So you mentioned there's a range of causes, like it can be genetically induced, and that's like 10% of cases, it's most likely genetically induced?
Yeah, well, it's a little bit overrepresented in our clinic, but, you know, if you take overall everyone with motor neurone disease, it's 10%, but 90% is sporadic, so out of the blue.
Out of the blue. So if it is in the family, if mum or dad have it, or grandma and grandpa have it, what's the likelihood of you inheriting that from your parents, for example?
Most motor neurone disease or monogenic forms of motor neurone disease are inherited in a dominant fashion. So if one of your parents has the faulty gene, you stand a 50-50 chance of inheriting the gene. And a lot of the work we do is with genetic counselling. We have an embedded genetic counsellor in our motor neurone disease service to handle preclinical testing, and that also is a huge topic in and of itself, and we have been able to have 3 babies born to our clinic. One of the parents has a faulty gene. We know absolutely categorically the babies don't have motor neurone disease. So that is it's in essence a cure.
Is it growing? Are incidences of MND growing in Australia?
Yes. Yeah. So in the last 30 years, as a cause of death in Australia, it's gone from 1 in 500 to about 1 in 180.
Wow. Does that mean you're just better at diagnosing it?
This is what kills you when you die. So doctors are pretty good at filling out death certificates. And we're one of the few places in the world that we have a nationalised death certification process with birth, deaths and marriages. So ICD-10 code for motor neurone disease, G12.2, you know, on the death certificate, if motor neurone disease occurs on that death certificate, it's attributed to motor neurone disease.
So you're saying it's more than doubled in the last couple of decades then?
Yeah, 257% in 30 years.
Well, right. Well, that's vaguely alarming, I think, isn't it? Yep. Once someone has MND, what treatment can you offer them? Can you prolong life through this or that?
Yeah, absolutely. So with supportive care. So in many phases of medicine, if you have good multidisciplinary patient-centric care, you dramatically improve people's outcomes. Now, that's not necessarily a sexy thing to say because people want the machine that goes ping and the special magic bullet. But if you just look after people with good physio, speech, dietitian, supportive care, respiratory care, you double people's survival.
I suppose then we have to get to the issue of what triggers your own body to start killing neurons. What is turning these little assistant cells rogue on the neurons? How close are we to finding an answer to that, Dominic?
Well, there are many theories, and like any area of endeavour, when there are many, many theories, there's often not a lot of fact. So everyone wants to know why. Why did I get motor neurone disease? And there are epidemiologic studies that do point to areas where motor neurone disease is perhaps overrepresented. So one of the most robust studies comes from southern France, near a very famous lagoon called the Thor Lagoon near Montpellier.
Right, south of France, near the Mediterranean.
Yeah. So this is one of the sites of oyster and mussel production in France, and they have meticulous records going back years and years and years. And in France, in Australia, motor neurone disease is not a notifiable condition. In France, there is a registry that exists in Paris. If you live on the western side of the Thor Lagoon, within 5 kilometres of the shore, you have a 3 to 5-fold increased incidence of motor neurone disease. If you live on the eastern side, you don't.
And are there similar clusters in Australia?
We think so. So we've been very interested in the Riverina in the MIA over the last 8 years because of what we do in looking after patients, no matter where they come from. So we look after lots of patients from rural and regional New South Wales, and it seems to be from Griffith and Leeton and Narrandera. We've got too many people.
Podcast, broadcast and online. You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio. Hear more conversations anytime on the ABC Listen app or go to abc.net.au/conversations.
You mentioned that there's a lake in France, and on people living on one side of the lake are 5 times as likely to get motor neurone disease than people living on the other side.
And within 5 kilometres of the shore.
Within 5 kilometres of the shore, okay. And then you say in Australia, you think there may be clusters in Australia in the Riverina. These are all places with bodies of water. Is there a possible connection between water or what is in the water in such places and a higher incidence of motor neurone disease?
We think that there is. And the difficulty is that co-association is not causality. Our observation first that we see more people than we think we should be seeing from the MIA, from the Murrumbidgee, could be for many reasons. You know, epidemiologists will just say, look, it's referral bias and what have you.
You mean essentially these two things are happening at the same time. It does not necessarily mean that one is causing the other.
Exactly.
In other words, there could be a third factor here that we don't see or...
More than three. Yeah. You know, we know that Neil Danaher, for example, the Freeze the G and the fantastic work that Fight M&D are doing down in Melbourne. So he comes from the Murrumbidgee, from south of Lake Cajelico. Barellan, so a tiny town, the home of Yvonne Corley, has a way overrepresented number of people with motor neurone disease. And it's only just recently that with sophisticated genetics that we can make sure that it's not genetic, that it's sporadic, because that's what you have to do first is to make sure that it's not a faulty gene and that's just genetic clusters.
Right, families living too long by that lake and cousins marrying that kind of thing.
But even around Lake Cajelico, so, you know, again, a tiny, tiny town that does have historical algal blooms. So we're particularly interested in cyanobacteria. And this is about a 50-year story that goes back to Guam, where post-Second World War on the island of Guam, the US protectorate, the doctors there noticed that a lot of the Chamorro people, the local Indians, native people, died from neurodegenerative disease that in the eyes of some of the doctors looked like motor neurone disease, in the others it looked like Parkinson's disease, in the other it was dementia. So they called it this Guam dementia, motor neurone disease, Parkinsonism complex. That was attributed initially to cycads.
What are cycads?
Cycads are a plant that were used to create flour, so the nuts of cycads. And we have many hundreds of different cycads in Australia, but cycads fix nitrogen through cyanobacteria in their root system. And these bacteria produce substitute amino acids that concentrate through the nuts. The Chamorro people would make their flour out of the nuts of the cycad. And the theory was that it was a toxin called BMAA or beta-methyl-amino-alanine.
BMAA, toxin produced in the roots of certain plants that would then produce nuts that would then be ground into flour in Guam, in this place in Guam.
And fruit bats would eat the nuts, and that was the delicacy too. People would eat fruit bat stew. And that the theory was that this motor neurone disease complex was caused by BMAA.
But people in living near this lake in France and in the Riverina area presumably aren't making flour out of the nuts of cycads, are they? Or eating fruit bats, as far as I know.
True.
So how does that connect?
Well, these cyanobacteria are everywhere. Cyanobacteria live in water. They live in earth. They live in the roots of plants. So
algae?
Well, it's called algae. It's called blue-green algae, but it's not necessarily blue or green, so they can be orange.
Right.
And they're not algae. They're bacteria. So
you're saying to me blue-green algae is neither necessarily blue or green or algae.
That's
right. Okay. So it can be in whatever that is. And that sits on the surface of water, doesn't it?
Great thing about cyanobacteria is that they've evolved to be able to photosynthesize. So bacteria don't photosynthesize, but blue-green algae can. So what they do in water is that when you've got water with low oxygen and high nutrients, they breed and they can go up and down in the water to fix nitrogen and to photosynthesize to survive, whereas the plants in the water will die. So if you look at Western New South Wales, the Darling Murray system 50 years ago, you could scuba dive in the Darling River. You can't now. It's a muddy soup. All the plants are gone. So there's low oxygen, there's high nutrients, and they breed cyanobacteria. So Lake Wyangan, just outside of Griffith, is closed most of the year because of cyanobacterial bloom, as is Lake Albert in Wagga. Now, if those two lakes are a microcosm for everything that happens in the Murrumbidgee irrigation area, you know, can we dot the dots to make this into a cogent argument? Now, it may not just be cyanobacteria. You know, that's what we've been studying in one of our avenues of endeavour. But we've also done lots of other things to our water that I think is going to come back and hit us. European carp destroying the native plants, fertilisers, insecticides, herbicides.
Oxygen-poor water, with lots of nutrients in it, and then that's the breeding ground for cyanobacteria.
Bang.
Is there blue-green algae or something like that in this lake in Montpellier in France?
Yes, indeed. That's what they've done. That's the really amazing thing. They did what's called a time cluster analysis in this study. So they went back and looked at records of oysters and mussels and water so that they meticulously catalogued for decades. And they looked at the spike of blue-green algae remnants in the oysters and mussels and the water. And they produced a time cluster co-association to the index cases around about 5 to 10 years before the incident cases.
If this connection can be established, or maybe it is, do you consider this established?
No.
We don't?
No.
Okay. We're still in the kind of looking at the data phase at the moment, are we?
Yeah.
Yeah. If it is established, though, this will have really big public policy ramifications, I would have thought.
Yeah.
In terms of how the river system is treated.
Yeah. And water. You know, in Australia, we turn the tap on. You think that your water should be safe. And that might not be the case. I think that there's been a lot of work done on bringing up the water systems up to speed. We need to be very careful about, you know, making sure that we don't overblow the message of co-association. It's not causality. But, you know, when you're sitting there with someone who's got motor neuron disease in front of you and you're not actually asking questions as to what's the cause or the trigger of this, you know, the causes and triggers we may not be able to do anything about. So what's ubiquitous in the environment we may not be able to stop, but it will tell us and inform us and teach us what are the processes that produce this disease so we can get the brakes on and turn a 3-year survival into a 10, 15, 20-year survival. So that's the critical thing of understanding what the triggers might be.
I was reading a bit about this, and for a little while there was a theory that might connect head injuries to MND.
Yes, yeah, indeed.
But then someone put up their hand and said, you might just want to flip the causality around in that. If you've got, you know, oncoming motor neuron disease, you're more likely to fall over and hurt your head. So it might be the incipient MND that causes the head injury than the head injury causing the MND.
Look, this epidemiology is very difficult because of what's called recall bias. So it probably is that head injury is associated with neurodegenerative disease, whether it's chronic traumatic encephalopathy, which we see in the NFL players, or Parkinson's disease, which there does appear to be an association with head injury, or motor neuron disease. It comes back to the knight and the valet. It doesn't necessarily matter how the knight is injured, whether it's electrical injury, which seems to be overrepresented in people with motor neuron disease. So people who have had significant electrical injury, whether it's lightning or 240 volts, you know, electrical professions are overrepresented in patients that we see with motor neuron disease. So again, there are tantalizing clues. Even having said that, the specific trigger may not necessarily be relevant for the process once that that inflammation, the fire is set up in the nervous system. It may not necessarily matter what the trigger was.
You know, I suppose laymen like me are always looking for a simple explanation for things. Like, you know, reading and writing about the Black Death in the 6th century Mediterranean, you know, they don't know what's going on. It's this, the Black Death courses through these cities, causes awful mayhem. It kills the virtuous and the wicked alike. And then how could they have known it was a kind of a rod-shaped bacterium inside a flea? Yersinia pestis that gets into a rat and so on and so forth. And we go, aha! There it is. It's that thing. It's that one thing. But it sounds to me like you're not expecting it to be that one thing. It may well be a combination of several things.
It may be a combination of things. And also, I think the reaction of the central nervous system to the injury is going to be critical. So we need to understand the genetics of that in sporadic motor neuron disease, because it's a useful analogy to think of the disease as produced by a genetic soil and a seed that's the trigger. And so it depends on the conditions of the soil and the timing of the seed, whether the disease actually evolves into its full-blown disastrous nature that is motor neuron disease.
You were doing medicine and medical research, you're sort of following the family business because your dad was a doctor.
Yeah.
Did your dad encourage you to be a doctor, and were you always going to be a doctor, Dominic?
Well, truth be told, I did a lot of maths and science in high school, and I'd done a lot of research in year 12, and I decided that I was going to do computing science at UTS. And I filled out my UCAC form, and the form came home. And Dad, you know, I'm one of six kids. Both my parents worked full time. My mum, God bless her, she had 20 kids. She had six kids over 20 years. Six kids over 20 years.
Not 20 kids over 6 years.
No, right. That'd be too much. And so Dad intercepted the window envelope and opened it up, and he said, we need to have a talk about this. I said, okay. He said, computing science at UTS. And I said, yep, that's what I want to do. He said, I don't think you should do that. And I said, why? So this is 1982. He said, I don't think there's a future in computers.
It's a mug's game.
It is a mug's game. Right. So he said you're going to go and do medicine at Sydney, so go in and change your UCAC form, which you had to do then by StatDec. You couldn't just log on and change it. You had to actually get a form out and go and do it.
Right. You could have been the next Jonty Ives sitting there, or Steve Jobs or something like that, but no. You went into the worthless business of medical research. What a shame.
Like I said before, I've been pretty concrete, but I've also had a knack for solving problems. So I don't see a difference between the different, you know, jobs. And I do a lot of computing as it is, and have always done a lot of computing stuff. But so, you know, and I wouldn't swap what I do for anything. So I'm really, really privileged to do what I do, because no 2 days are the same. And, you know, the truly amazing thing is that you see the tenacity and courage and amazing spirit of the people that you have the privilege to look after. So it's a unique position to be in, to look after people in various different aspects of these diseases, whether it's motor neuron disease or Parkinson's disease or stroke or autoimmune encephalitis, or, you know, whatever it is that happens, to put it into the context for the person in ways that they can understand it, to try and fix what you can fix, and if you can't fix it, how to adapt to it, is and also being of help, being there to, you know, people know that if they're in trouble that they can pick up the phone or come in, or if they need help, then we can do that.
We always imagine that, of course, the families and close friends of the person with the condition are going to be supportive, I'm sure, and that often happens. Do you often see the case, though, where the patient is being supportive of the people around them?
Absolutely. And this is one of the things that you try, especially with early on in the diagnosis, is often there's it, it's a real awful day, you know, and sometimes you see the person with the problem actually comforting their friends and families, you know, saying, look, it's okay, you know.
They're upset because their condition has caused distress in the people that they
absolutely
love.
Yeah. Well, one of my patients who was a professor at Macquarie, and unfortunately we've had six staff members over the last 20 years at Macquarie with motor neurone disease, and that may underpin why, you know, Macquarie has actually cut loose.
Well, hang on. Six staff at Macquarie have had motor neurone disease?
Yeah, professional and academic staff over 20 years.
Is that because you're recruiting people who have it to help them work? Or is this just by sheer coincidence? Or
yeah. Well, again, with such low-frequency disease, it's very hard to get, you know, similar to there's occasional little flurries that occur with clusters of different diseases that occur in different professional environments. But one of my patients many years ago, Chris, who was the professor of brain behaviour and evolution at Macquarie. So his expertise was working out how animals talk to each other. So his specific international acclaim was that he worked out how chickens communicate. And this disease is really cruel. It you know, took his ability to talk. So, and Chris had a wicked sense of humour, and with the catastrophe of the diagnosis of motor neurone disease, he printed up identical T-shirts that said, "I'm not dead yet." So, and you find this gallows humour, and it's one of the great privileges of looking after Australians from wherever they come from. The courage is really quite amazing.
Can I ask a really, really, might be a really stupid question. Is it possible motor neurone disease is contagious then?
In terms of ALS, we think it's highly unlikely that it's contagious. But there are, that doesn't mean that it's not necessarily related to viral elements. So we've just completed a trial here in Australia, which was the world's first trial, using a repurposed drug from the HIV world called Triumeq. So one of the theories of sporadic motor neurone disease is that you have these very old remnants in your DNA reactivate for whatever reason, whether it's BMAA or head injury or whatever, but they reactivate, and that might be part of the process of why the valet becomes irritated by the, you know, irritable and tries to kill the knight. But we just finished this trial repurposing this therapy called Triumeq, which is two reverse transcriptase inhibitor and an integrase inhibitor. And these are very potent medicines that are used in HIV medicine. So HIV can cause a motor neurone disease lookalike, but this is not HIV. Right. This is a thing called a human endogenous retrovirus. So in our DNA, nearly 10% of our DNA is made up of these very old viral remnants that we've accumulated through evolution. And one of the theories is that these remnants reactivate, and then the inflammation sets up and neurons start getting damaged. So there could be an infectious element. I don't think motor neurone disease is transmissible.
Right. That's. I just want to be clear about that. So the care
so
is...
Can't, a,
right.
You can't give it to anyone. Right. You can't catch it. There are a couple of exceptions to that. So over the last 20 years... I've looked after two husband-wife where the husband had motor neurone disease, and after the husband died, 2 or 3 years later, the wife developed motor neurone disease.
But they're living together in the same environment.
Could well be environmental. No one has ever successfully transmitted ALS or motor neurone disease from one animal to another. So you can't catch it, you can't give it to anyone.
This new treatments you're trialling at the moment, what do they? How are they able to help? Can they extend the life of someone with MND?
We hope so. So we finished what's called a phase one trial. So is this drug safe to give to people? And this is the first time in the world that this therapy has been given to large numbers of people with motor neurone disease. So large numbers is only 40. So 40 Australians very bravely took this Triumeq, and that trial finished in February this year. And Professor Julian Gold from the Albion Street Clinic is the principal investigator of that trial, and he's in the process of finishing up the paper. He presented the findings at the European Network to Cure ALS in June. And we're very hopeful, we're very optimistic that we have signals that there has been some effect in slowing motor neuron disease down. We can't yet prove that because it's not in the stage of a trial that we can say that it's better than standard therapy. So we're optimistic, cautiously, but we need to temper that optimism with the lack of black and white results.
We talked earlier about the way you are sometimes, it's your job to let patients know they have MND and the prognosis isn't going to be good even in the medium term. Your dad died of cancer last year, and he was a doctor, like you said. How was he told about his death? Was he well prepared for that, and was he told the truth? No.
So none of the oncologists actually said to him, "You're going to die." And my dad had this armor of invincibility. So he was 80, and at the age of 80, it was the first time he was ever in hospital. He'd never been in hospital before until he was diagnosed, actually, by one of my mates who called me up one Friday afternoon and said, "Look, Dom, I think your dad's got renal cancer." He was a gastroenterologist, and he called me up as soon as he did the CT scan and said, "Look, I think this is really bad." And he had his kidney out, and it was diagnosed to be a very rare form of renal cancer called papillary cell carcinoma, which is you're on a hiding to nothing, really. There aren't any therapies that work. But it actually, unfortunately, fell to me.
Not his doctors?
No. So he said to me, so he had his kidney out, and he had metastatic, he had mets through his body, and he had this big tumour burden. He went from 80 kilos to 50-odd kilos in 3 months and had this big, you know, hypermetabolic state. And he looked at me one morning and he said, "Is this survivable?" And I said, "No, Dad, this is not survivable."
And you were the first doctor to tell him that?
Yeah.
Do you think we're not good about talking about these things?
No, we're terrible.
How can we do better with that?
Well, to stop using euphemisms. Look, the courage of people when you tell them that, you know, things are not good, but you'll be there with them and help to look after them. Most people, their courage and straight up and down approach is, as you would expect, and you know, couching death in pseudo terms, I think, is counterproductive. But it's a very common thing, unfortunately. I think, you know, my dad would have done anything to continue to live, and so he clung on to that because the doctors kept on giving him what were experimental therapies at his request. That's what he wanted to do. So there was this sort of like folly of two between my dad and the oncologists. And, you know, I'm not taking a swipe at oncologists. They do an amazing job, and really cancer biology and cancer medicine is, you know, I'm envious of how brilliantly they've used basic science to pretty much turn many forms of cancer on its head. Like, take melanoma, for example. But my dad's concept of his invincibility, I think, was played along with.
Just finally, in the course of your career, how much has changed in terms of what we now know about neurodegenerative diseases like the ones you study?
A huge amount, dramatically. So in 1996, when I did my doctorate with Glenda Halliday and Stan Appel on inflammatory mechanisms in Parkinson's disease and motor neuron disease, that was thought to be a fringe topic. It's now front and centre. That's where everyone is focusing on therapies to slow and stop the disease.
Well, it's been amazing hearing the story of this and your own career as well. And thank you so much, Dominic.
Richard, thank you so much.
I spoke to Dominic Rowe back in 2018, and today's conversation will be available for you very soon as a podcast, abc.net.au/conversations is our website. It's all there for you to help yourself to any podcast that your heart desires from any one of our programs over the last, well, 1.5 million years or so. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.